Welcome back to the Chain Gang podcast. Today I'm joined by a very special guest, Jennifer George. She's been a cyclist on pretty much all the best stages in the UK and across Europe. Now she's coaching, she's working with a lot of different foundations, and yeah, she's a pretty great person to get to talk to. So how are you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really good, thank you. I'm looking forward to a nice chat this morning.
Yeah, so how have you been dealing with all the different things you do? Because obviously you coach as well as everything else you do in lockdown.
So yes, it's as I'm sure everybody's in the same boat, it's been quite an odd and very interesting time. It's kind of taken things away that I would normally do, which at this time of year would be mainly racing with a bit of coaching and working with my technical gym family on sort of the odd day here and there. At the moment, obviously we're not racing. I'm still training because we've been lucky enough to still be allowed to train outdoors. And I'm still coaching, but as gyms are all shut and business is kind of difficult with Techno Gym because they are a gym kit supplier, we don't have much work, contract work with them at the moment. A few things are starting to come through with the increase in home purchases, so we're going to be doing some Zoom stuff with them. But yeah, I'm pretty quiet in the moment compared to normal. Apart from obviously my coaching clients, I've been lucky enough that they've all wanted to continue despite all their events also being cancelled.
Yeah, so how much has coaching changed? Is it just the kind of nature of not having anything to plan for, or is it having to do it remotely? But I figured a lot of training is done. Coaching is done remotely now that we can, with Training Peaks and whatever. So how much has it actually changed?
I guess it's the main thing that's changed is that I was ramping everybody up and for their first events of the season, most of them starting sort of March, April time. And as soon as the lockdown hit and the news came that all these events were being cancelled, we just scaled everything back. Until we kind of knew exactly what was going on. So we kind of went down the route of kind of scaling things back to doing more winter type training. Most of my coaching is remote. I do the odd group session here and there, but a lot of mine is one-to-one, so I'm planning things on Training Peaks for people. So we scaled it all back. We're kind of, it sounds really dull, but back to kind of more winter training, kind of more base work, working on people's weaknesses a little bit more because we had a little bit more time to do that. And then we kind of developed that a little bit because a few of my clients have said, well, you know what, I'm not going to do anything else this year, so I might as well do a little bit of Zwift racing. So we've stepped things up so that they could be more competitive doing that. But then I've still got some clients that are hoping to do some events towards the end of the season that have been rescheduled. So we're kind of holding off and starting to ramp up now towards those. But I guess, like, in terms of coaching, the way it's changed, we've just literally had to put an extra block of base in, basically, and work on things that perhaps we wouldn't normally have a lot of time to work on pre-season.
Yeah, and so obviously that's affected you coaching-wise. How have you found it being on the other side of the coin as well, obviously as the rider? It must be hard, I presume, for the first time in your career, not really having anything to aim for.
It's the weirdest thing in the world. it's surreal. It's that kind of like, are we going to ride at the end of the season? Are there going to be races? Is it going to happen? I mean, we're still in that situation, essentially. I mean, anything could happen in the next month or so. I mean, we're supposed to really start racing in sort of August, September time. We've definitely got races confirmed in September. There'll be some stuff happening in August as well, hopefully some time trials on top of that. But it's been really weird. I would, I'm in the lucky situation where I actually just love riding my bike. So that really helps. I think people who are very numbers driven and literally get on their bike and stare at their Garmin for 3, 4, 5 hours and get a kick out of the numbers that they produce, they'll possibly be struggling more than somebody like me. I actually quite enjoy training. I enjoy riding my bike, and I enjoy riding on feel sometimes. And you know what? I think that really, really helped over this period, because you have had to just chill out and just, yeah, enjoy the scenery a little bit.
Yeah, and I mean, so this is obviously quite a setback, but what are the other setbacks you've experienced in your career? And obviously, how exactly do you think they help you with the riders you coach? Do you think it puts you in a better place if you've had a setback that you can relate to them?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a number of setbacks in my career so far. I've also watched teammates have pretty serious setbacks as well over the last few years. And I mean, to name one, I was in an unlucky situation where I had quite what we call an innocuous crash in 2017, and got back on my bike as you do, adrenaline hit, finished the race, had a few days off, continued riding, and then 2 months later found out I'd actually fractured my tibia and literally completely annihilated my knee, and that's where the pain was coming from. And I mean, that was quite a crazy setback. I mean, there's lots of crazy things that have come out of that. And the result of that is that I have a greater understanding of when people are feeling a little bit low, or if they are coming back from an injury, what sort of the amount of patience that they require and the amount of time it is actually going to take. We don't all have the lucky situation where we have the best doctors in the world or the best support in the world to basically take us apart and put us back together at the drop of a hat. We some of us actually have to be quite patient, and understanding that and being able to guide clients to being that patient and assuring them that it will be all right, but they have to just take the stepping stones has really shaped me. Also, before I had that crash, I was a personal trainer, and I'd done sort of strength and conditioning, etc., etc. But I hadn't actually done all my coaching qualifications. So when I actually got injured, I brought kind of my forward plan into that year and did all my coaching qualifications while I was injured, keep my brain working if I couldn't use my body. So that kind of like shaped everything as well. So a lot of good actually happened from the bad of being pretty broken for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said just from the nature of the injury, quite how tough cyclists are, which I know they get a lot of. Very similar to when I was playing rugby and people used to just like play on for weeks with broken ankles or whatever and then finally find out. But in terms of something that's really coming to the fore now, how did you manage it mentally? Because obviously such a big setback takes a big strain on your mental health.
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that. I mean, I've always thought of myself as being pretty level-headed, and kind of like, yeah, fairly straightforward sort of person, but I did go through some pretty low points. I had the accident in the May. I found out in the July that I had, I literally was at the point where the doctors were saying, if you don't stop, your fracture is going to become full thickness. You've got such bad bone bruising that your legs in a really bad state, And then obviously you've literally torn like everything in your knee as well. So you need to sit and do nothing. So I was going from the day before fighting through the pain deadlifting in the gym to the next day being told that you need to sit on the sofa and do nothing for the next 6-8 weeks, and then we'll reassess where we're at and try and sort the knee out. So mentally that was really, really difficult to cope with. And I guess, like on the other side, I had a teammate who had literally the week before had a really bad crash as well. And she was, although I was in a bad way, she was in a very much worse place than me because her injuries were more visible. Mine weren't visible. You couldn't see that I had an injury. Unless you knew it, you wouldn't really have known. And she was in a very much worse place than me, because hers were visible. And it was actually quite interesting. We actually bounced off of each other, and we were a really good support network. And I would always say that the best thing that you can do is talk to somebody who's close to you and have those conversations. And all the better if you've got somebody who is going through or has been through something similar. I started to, in the July, plan Christmas, which sounds really weird. But I used that as my goal, as something to look forward to. And I started to kind of plan things ahead that I could really, in my own mind, just really look forward to. And I think that really, really helped me. And I look back at it and it was quite a dark place.
Yeah. Because I, having never been at any decent level of cycling, obviously I played rugby, but what was this? Was there any support network for things like that in place, or was it just kind of you were left to your own devices there?
So it was a funny old situation, and I don't think anybody really knew particularly how to help me, because in the first instance it was sit and do nothing for 6 weeks, and then I got reassessed and had a fresh MRI, and I was told some pretty horrific things that they wanted to do to correct the situation, which was that I basically did. The 6-8 weeks had healed the fracture, the bone bruising had reduced, but the knee was never going to be right again. And they wanted to do a pretty serious operation on my knee. And it was basically posed to me as, if you don't have this operation, this is as good as it's going to get now. And at that point, I couldn't walk properly. I couldn't go up and down stairs properly. I certainly couldn't push off and ride a bike properly. And so I was basically, and without going too much into it, I was basically told, if you have this operation, you might walk properly, you could possibly ride a bike again. If you do not have this operation, you will never walk, run, or ride a bike properly again. So it's a pretty interesting situation to be in. And at that point, just shortly after that, my team decided that they weren't going to renew. And so I was pretty much left on my own, apart from my friend and my husband, luckily. He's been a superb, like an amazing support to me over the years. And so, yeah, it was, I'd love to say that I had all the support in the world, but actually at the point where contracts were being renewed, I was told this news and then I was dropped. For my team. So yeah, I didn't really have any.
Yeah, no, and mentally that must be quite a challenge. But we seem to see this happening all too often at the elite level. I know certainly some of the national organisations have it, and a lot of the elite programmes have it, where riders get mental health issues, not necessarily injuries, and they end up being dropped from their team because their performances aren't matching up, because they're not getting support. I don't know how much experience you have with that, with riders you're coaching or anything like that.
Yeah, I think I think it just happens. You hear more and more about it. A lot of people don't talk about it until they've really retired, about the struggle that they've gone through in through their career. I guess that I'm happy to talk about that sort of thing, because I think it's important that people, that we're open and honest about the support that we are and aren't getting. Mental health is a huge thing on a day-to-day life, and it becomes even more important when you're trying to compete. Without injury, I see a lot of issues in the peloton, mental health issues, and it's I'm hoping that it's going to become less of a taboo and people will talk about it more and it will decrease, but I think that it will always have, there will always be a presence of mental health issues. And unless there's more money in the sport, it's going to be very difficult for people to get past them.
Yeah, and I think cycling itself hasn't had the best past anyway. So I think it just seems to switch from one secret to another and these kind of hidden problems that can come out. And there's another thing that a lot of people talk about in cycling. I'm not sure if you've got any experience with knowing people who've been in this boat or anything like that. I know for me, what I see from it now is that Zwift is only going to make this worse. But there's a big kind of problem with eating disorders in cycling now because of how important power to weight is. So have you ever encountered anything like that?
Yeah, so I include this sort of mental health as within the eating disorder realm as well, and that's a big one that you do see, that you can actually almost physically identify quite easily in the peloton. I mean, I'm lucky enough that I've never had an issue like that. If anybody knows me, then they kind of understand that. I think it is a big issue that people feel that they need to be really, really light and have a really good power to weight ratio, but they forget that actually that there comes a point where your power will decrease if you are not putting enough food and nourishment into your body. You've got to feed it. It's a fuel. You've got to, your body's an engine. You've got to fuel it. And unless you fuel it effectively, you won't get the very best out of it. And if you're a couple of kilos heavier, at the end of the day, that actually might get you up the mountain faster than if you're undernourished and too light. And yeah, you might feel okay, but you certainly won't recover for the next day if it's a stage race. I can't stress to people how important it is that you are the right weight for your body, that you are still having a menstrual cycle. Not having a menstrual cycle affects so many things for later in life, and whilst you don't think it's going to affect you now, which it possibly won't, other than your recovery, etc., but you have to look at things like your bone density, because it will affect that. And then that's your longevity later in life, of being able to be fit and active and possibly still ride a bike and, I don't know, do masters and vet stuff on your bike if you so wish, or just be able to ride to the shops when you're a little bit older and you've retired from racing. It's so important to look after your body now. It's not a machine. It's not a machine that you abuse. You've got to look after it to get the best out of it.
Yeah, and you know, that's a message I think is pretty important. I know a lot of cyclists who have been through it and come out the other side and basically said exactly what you said, straight from what they went through. Mm-hmm. And like, I just think the culture of Zwift and the number of people on Zwift who lie about their weight and stuff like that, I think is creating a very, very unhealthy surrounding for cycling, where people feel that if they can push this power, then if only they were this weight, they could push that power. And yeah. and like it just seems all a bit of a dangerous way to be headed. But I guess Zwift aren't an official organization. They don't really have a duty to look after people. So they are just a company at the end of the day. So I guess that's the way we're going.
Yeah. Just another point, particularly on the Zwift thing. I mean, it is a sad reality. People do lie about their weight. My coach and I actually have a bit of a joke going on, saying that if you want to lose some weight, the best thing you can do is actually sign up to Zwift, because you just put in whatever weight you want to put in. And that is a real, it probably sounds a bit like off that, and a bit of a kind of weird joke, but it is the reality, is that people are signing up for Zwift and they just put in their wish weight and crack on. And in my view, you're only really cheating yourself if you're doing something like that. And I don't know how we stop it, but then if we do try and stop it, then does that bring in the area for these eating disorders to take hold of people's lives and in many cases ruin their lives? It's a very difficult, gentle balancing act between getting good sportsmanship and not encouraging eating disorders.
Yeah, I think the fortunate thing is when they're competing at the elite level, obviously all the athletes have got official weights that they've been registered. So fortunately, they can't set a bad example. I mean, not the best, probably the worst thing that could happen was Cam Jeffers being disqualified from the British E Nationals for cheating. By doing a zero weight fix or whatever. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about home stretch. So for those people that don't know, what is home stretch?
So the Home Stretch Foundation was set up by a lady called Catherine Bertine. She's an ex-pro. She rode for Sealant and she also rode for Wiggle. She's an American, but she also rode for St. Kitts and Nevis. And one of the things that she saw was that there was a huge gap in the male and female cycling pro scene, and a huge inequality in the way that we had coverage on TV and to many extents the support that we had. So as she was retiring, she had this dream to set up a house where she could house female pro athletes free of charge, and all they would have to do was get themselves there and pay for their food. All the accommodation would be free and they could use the house and train and share best practice and bond as a group. And it was her way of kind of giving back, but also promoting the need for change within the sport. And so she mainly houses female cyclists, but will take males if there is space, and will also take triathletes as well. I've been lucky enough to be there a couple of times. The house is in Tucson, in Arizona, and it's basically funded by donation and the local community particularly donating towards that as well. I think they get donations from Amazon. You can donate when you buy stuff from Amazon, particularly in America. I don't think it's available in the UK to do that, but so it's a non-profit foundation, and it's an incredible place. I mean, I was lucky enough to go there 2 years running. I went there at the beginning of 2017 and also 2018 as well. and spent a month staying in the house, training, and meeting other female pros and just training with them. And it's just a really good environment to be in, where you can learn as well as train in good weather. Because the time of year that it's good to go to Tucson is when it's cold, wet, miserable in Europe. So it is the best place to train. It's dry, it's warm, and yeah, it's a load of fun as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's definitely something important, because there definitely is a massive difference in what the women's teams offer compared to the men's teams. And I personally, I had the same chat with Alex Spratt, and he absolutely agreed with me. I generally find women's racing more exciting, so it baffles me that this is the way it is. Like, my favourite ever stage in my life of watching cycling was the finish of La Course when Annemiek van Vleuten won. And that is one of the most mental things I've ever seen. And yet, you know, the support network around that is nothing compared to what a domestique riding in the male pro conti level will get. So it's bizarre, and it's things like this that help. So you've obviously used it a few times. Just like, what do you come back with? How do you feel when you come back from that? Do you feel stronger? Do you feel like perhaps a change is coming? It's positive.
Because of the environment that we're in, it's the encouragement that you get from the other girls, you come back so motivated for the start of the season. If you can place your time there, it's close to when you start the season, you come back just kind of hungry for the start of the season. You come back fitter. The key difference is here over winter, as you'll know, it can be pretty miserable. It can be a couple of things. It can be wet, it can be cold, it can be windy, it can just generally just be horrible, like for months on end. Whereas if you go over to somewhere like Tucson to train, it's so dry there. And if you do get rain, I found this out actually, it was really funny. One day it rained and I went out to go and do one of the local group rides and no one else turned up. I was the only person that turned up for this group ride, and normally 100 riders turn up for it. And I got back to the house and the other girls were up and I was like, why weren't you coming to the group ride? And they're like, well, it's raining. And I was like, and we ride in the rain? And they were like, you don't hear. And sure enough, about 2 hours later, it was dry. We went out on the roads and they were just full of cyclists. It's just the culture over there is like, because it's always dry, if it does rain, it'll be dry in a couple of hours. Just ride then, delay, it's fine. But it was the funniest thing. I felt like such a loser. I turned up to this group ride. and you come back from that with a kind of that, as I said, that hunger. You're fitter because you've been able to train more, but more effectively as well. You can, they've got flat roads, they've got a few climbs, so that the training that you can do out there is very diverse and you can use your time very, very effectively. And then once you're done riding, you've not got all the other worries that you have when you're at home, where you've got chores to do and things. Yes, granted, you need to keep the house clean and stuff and you need to cook your food, but that's literally all you need to do. There's no other noise. It's all blocked out. So you can ride effectively, recover effectively, and share best practice, meet other riders. So when you go to your next race, 9 times out of 10, you've got people in the other teams that you know because you've literally just shared a house with them for a month.
Yeah, and obviously you said about the culture being different in terms of riding in the rain. Now, I've always found as soon as I ride in any different country, anywhere in Europe, I just love it. Like the first few days, if I'm riding somewhere else, I just love everything about it. How is it properly immersing yourself into a different cycling culture in a different way to just going to a race or a training? Well, it's kind of a training camp, it's a bit different than that. Do you find just absorbing this new culture is it helps you mentally? It gives you kind of a new outlook on life, which helps you in more than just cycling.
Yeah, it's that sharing of knowledge and stuff while you're there. You're not just at a training camp meeting your teammates and going out and doing some rides together and doing some through and off and some chain gang practice and things like that. Yes, you do all that, but there is also the ability to just go out and have a ride where you can relax and see the scenery a little bit as well. Quite often, for instance, if you go to a race, people are like, yeah, you went to California, you did a tour of California, awesome. You must have loved seeing the countryside. What was it like? Was it hilly? Was it flat? Was it this? Was it that? And I'm like, well, I saw the wheel and somebody's bum for like 4 hours. I wanted to chew my handlebars. I wish that they were mint chocolate chip flavored. And yeah, we went up some really big steep climbs and the air was really thin because we were at altitude and I crossed the line and wanted to die. But it was great fun. And they're like, so you didn't see the country? And I was like, no. When you go and race somewhere, you see the back of a car, you see the middle of the peloton. You don't see a lot of the country at all, because when you're not on your bike, you just want to sleep, and you should sleep, and you should recover. Whereas going to somewhere like Tucson, because it's so far away and you go for quite a long time, you have the opportunity to see a little bit of the area. Either from a bike, or you might you'll have your rest day. You might go and see some stuff. I mean, we've been to see some of the animals out there. We've got some really cool, like sort of indigenous animals, and you meet other people and you make friends for life that actually live there, who you're friends on Facebook, and you just increase your network. That's something that you don't really do when you go to a proper training camp with just your teammates. You don't really mix with the local population. A lot of the things that I do when I've done when I'm out there is help the community. So they've obviously put quite a lot of money into the Home Stretch Foundation. One of the things is that you're expected to do when you're there is to give back. And one of the things that I did, because I'm a coach, is that I got involved in the local cycling community. Called El Grupo, and it's a community where all the kids go after school and they ride bikes together. They don't need to be amazing bike riders, they just need to be interested in riding bikes. They don't need to have their own bike because the local community has donated bikes to the cause. And they have younger groups of sort of 4 to 8 year olds, and then they have like groups from 8 to say all the way up to 17, and they take them out on rides. They do mountain biking, they do some road riding, and I used to go along there at least once a week, and I would go out on the road ride and do a little bit of coaching, encouraging, helping them with their training, and just generally talking to these young kids about kind of what it's like to race, but also what it's like just to kind of ride a bike full time. And yeah, it's a really great cause. These kids otherwise, I mean, I think the idea is to stop them hanging about in street corners and things. And they don't need any particular money to get to be able to do it. It's just like, it's like a kids club, but they ride bikes and it's so awesome. I would love to see more of that sort of thing in the UK. But I don't know whether it's possible or not, whether there's the interest yet.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I say it a lot when I'm talking to people, and I know certain people would disagree with me, but I've always found cycling in the UK particularly at the younger levels, but also kind of at the Cat 4, Cat 3 levels, to be just a massive clique, really. And turning up to a race as someone who's not been there before isn't the most friendly experience. And if you're not in, you're not in, and that's kind of it. Until you start performing on the bike, people don't tend to speak to you. So it's nice that there are these cultures where you can go away, and I guess that's a positive. And obviously America, their relationship with cycling falls in and out. I mean, they had their big love and then it all turned out to be a fraud, and they're trying to build it back up now. They've got Chloe Dyger absolutely dominating, like, machine-level stuff. So I think it's good to see that out there. They're trying to encourage it. And, yeah, hopefully things like that are what pushes them forwards. And, yeah, maybe there is potential for it in the UK. Maybe there's not. I mean, when I go out in the UK, I have six-year-olds riding carbon Pinarellos, so I don't really know if perhaps we're too far gone for that kind of stuff. But anyway, thank you for joining me, Jen. It's been really interesting to hear everything you've had to say. You've had quite, I would say, a different career to some, but in other respects, not the same. You've obviously been through a lot of injuries, so it's been really interesting to, or that major injury, it's been really interesting to hear from you. I don't know if you want to plug anything, feel free to now.
No, everybody just ride your bike, have fun doing it. Don't look at the numbers too much. Yeah, they're important, but so is the love of the bike. It shouldn't be an elite sport. You shouldn't need to have all the gear in the world. You should be able to, I mean, I rock up to club rides on quite an old bike with my bar tape hanging off, and there's next to the guy, the 66-year-old with his Pinarello and things like that. And, you know, we need to learn. I've had people look at me and go, "Ooh, what's she doing turning up?" And that's fine. I'm quite thick-skinned, but we need to stop that kind of culture. We need to accept everybody who rides a bike, and particularly with the lockdown and the increase in people cycling. It's so important that we don't judge people by the length of their socks, by the type of cleats they're wearing, or by the type of bike they're riding, or what they're wearing. We need to accept people and encourage them. And slowly they will adapt and learn that maybe they need various bits and pieces, but we all started somewhere. I used to ride with a brim on my helmet that came with it. The disc next to my wheel, it took me years till I got rid of that. We all start somewhere and we all learn slowly but surely, and everybody needs to find their pathway, and we need not to be judging people as they go. We need to make the sport more inclusive.
Yeah, right. So thank you for coming. I'm sure you can find Jen on Instagram if you want to follow and find out more. I'm sure she'll be happy for you to drop her a message if you have any questions. And yeah, I don't know who I'll be back with next time, but I will see you then.